Hello and welcome. My name is Mary Agnes Carey, and I'm Partnerships Editor and a Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks for joining today's webinar on Covering Caregiving, Background and Strategies for Reporters Examining the Role for Families, Governments, and Communities. As 10,000 baby boomers become eligible for Medicare every day, family caregiving is a common issue in the lives of many Americans. Demographic shifts, such as longer lifespans and shrinking family sizes, may shape the scope and quality of caregiving for our aging population. Media coverage of family caregiving requires an understanding of the complex and wide-ranging issues involved. For instance, who currently takes care of our aging population? What role should federal and state governments play, if any, in providing, facilitating, or funding this care? Are communities and policymakers adequately responding not only to the needs of the elderly, but also the growing population of caregivers? What opportunities exist, such as family leave policies or tax credits, to enable caregivers to maintain financial stability? We have a fantastic panel of experts with us today to explore these questions and more. Our panelists are Edwin Walker, Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Community Living, Anna Gorman, a Senior Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Kathleen Kelly, Executive Director of the Family Caregiver Alliance, National Center on Caregiving, and Susan Reinhardt, Senior Vice President at AARP and Director of its Public Policy Institute. If you're tweeting today, please use our hashtag, KHNCaregiving. I'm going to start out with a few questions today, but I encourage you, our audience, to jump in as soon as possible with any questions or comments that you may have. We will have all of our panelists' full bios and presentations, along with other very helpful background information, available at our website, khn.org, as soon as possible after today's webinar concludes. So with all of that in mind, let's get started. At first, I'd like to talk about how family caregiving has changed in recent years. How does the aging of the baby boomers, longer lifespans, and shrinking family sizes shape caregiving for our aging population? For that, we'll turn to Edwin Walker with HHS Administration for Community Living. Edwin, it's all yours.
Well, thank you, Mary Agnes. We really appreciate having the opportunity to participate in today's webinar on such a critical topic. And as it relates to the question that you posed, you know, as we think about family caregiving, which is really the provision of care to an individual with some type of physical limitation or cognitive limitation, that concept has been around forever. It's really only within the past 20 to 30 years or so that we are really beginning to understand the impact of caregiving on individuals, on family systems, on the economy, and on policymaking. When we look at the history, we think back to perhaps 1975 in the Older Americans Act, which is the primary piece of legislation that we implement through the Administration on Aging within the Administration for Community Living. And back then, it recognized the importance of supporting family caregivers through the inclusion of provisions supporting model projects focused on the development of concepts like adult daycare, and subsequently continued to revise and update itself to include adult day health care and family respite services as examples. And we continued to watch what was developing within the states. There were a number of states that really took the leadership role in experimenting with family caregiving. And subsequently, as the Older Americans Act became reauthorized, there was in some way those state experiments helped really lay the groundwork for our premier program, the National Family Caregiver Support Program, which was created 15 years ago in the year 2000. But thanks to more recent research, the issue of family caregiving is really more visible now than ever before. Through the great work of entities like AARP and the Family Caregiver Alliance and the National Alliance for Caregiving, they've really given us a better understanding of who caregivers are and what they need. Equally important, this research that they've done has helped us better understand the economic value and impact of family caregiving and has provided us with the information we need to make a stronger case for the resources necessary to support family caregivers. Research has also helped us better understand the totality of what family caregivers actually do. And I would reference the recent AARP Home Alone study, and perhaps Susan or someone would mention that in more detail. But, for example, while family caregivers may have always performed complex medical tasks, we now know what those tasks are and what they entail. We also know how family caregivers feel about performing those tasks and what we as a society really need to do in order to better support them. Our survey here at the Administration for Community Living, our survey of caregivers that are served by our National Family Caregiver Support Program, really indicates that a significant number are doing more than just the basic assistance with activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living. In fact, 91% of our family caregivers manage the finances of their care recipients, and 88% perform medical tasks such as medication management or wound care. You mentioned the demographic shift, and we're seeing that clearly take place in our country, but it's also impacting family caregiving. As an example, caregivers of adults today are older than they were than their counterparts were over a decade ago. And we also know that as the age of caregivers increases, so do the number of hours devoted to caregiving. We're also seeing shifts in gender roles, and that's important to note. While women still carry the majority of caregiver burdens, increasingly we're seeing men become more involved in all aspects of providing care. And further, as life expectancy increases, it's reasonable to expect that the time spent in caregiving and in the caregiving role, that will also increase. This has many implications for increased burden and the possibility that caregivers will need more formal services and supports for longer durations. The work here at the Administration for Community Living that we've done through the National Family Caregiver Support Program, we've really seen that information and education needs of family caregivers have shifted. Early in the program's existence, we heard anecdotal evidence that seemed to indicate that caregivers needed basic program information, like what help was available and where can I go to get it. But most recently, we've seen or are starting to see that caregivers need more detailed information on the care recipient's condition, on drug interactions, on things like legal information or access to public programs. And we are really seeing family caregivers gravitate towards the greater use of assistive technologies of all types that can aid them in their work, whether it's like an app to track medications or doctor's appointments, to using medical equipment and other assistive devices to provide care. And so hopefully that addresses your first question.
I think that's terrific. And you mentioned AARP, and I'm going to turn to Susan Reithard to talk a little bit about her view on how family caregiving has changed in recent years.
Thank you very much, Edwin. Great introduction. And thank you for mentioning the Home Alone study that we did, and I'll get back to that later. But I wanted to address this demographic shift a little bit more, and there's a ratio that we call a caregiver support ratio. There it is. I call it the cliff, the caregiver cliff, because look at that. It's quite stark. It's very, very simple. This is a demographic ratio of people who are between the ages of 45 and 64, kind of that average age of a family caregiver, in relation to those who are over 80, which is upwards of those who would need the care. And you can see, if you're looking at this, in 2010, 5 years ago, we were the best we're going to be for the foreseeable future when we had 7 potential caregivers for every person 80-plus who might need one. And by 2030, so only 15 years from now, that's going down to 4.4 potential family caregivers to everyone who might need it, who's 80-plus. So that's huge. And then if you go to 2050, it's 3-to-1. So the care, that's why we call it a care gap or a cliff. And so that This information for the media in particular, we have found to be incredibly important. This has gotten policymakers' attention. It's just a visual that people get. Some find it quite alarming. And it is alarming.
It's quite stark.
So as simple as the data are, we have found this to be incredibly useful as a conversation starter. We also have another study that gets a lot of information. It's called Valuing the Invaluable. And that study we've been doing several times over the years. The most recent one was released this year. And it talks about the, it looks at 11 different studies. So it's what you call a meta-analysis. So looking at 11 different surveys and studies across the country, we say that in 2013, there's about 40 million family caregivers who are providing care to an adult with limitations in daily activities. The estimates vary. That's why we are trying to get an average here across these studies. And then if you estimate the number of hours they're doing on average and what it would cost if you were to hire a home care worker instead, that comes to $470 billion in 2013 numbers. And that's up from $450 billion just a few years before. This is another, we have this data by state, by the way. If anyone's interested, we can get you that. It's also online. So this is the national figure. Our state offices in particular like to use those state numbers, again, as a conversation starter. It's quite stark when you see those billions and millions of dollars at the state level.
It's real money.
I use it to say we have to make sure that family caregivers are more visible. They tend to be invisible, so let's shine a light on them, and let's really value what they're doing, their major contributions. So the next one we do to try to wrap your head around that, because it's such a big number, is trying to get some comparisons. So this number is more than the total dollars, federal and state dollars, spent on Medicaid in the country. It's actually four times more than the long-term care Medicaid dollars. And this is a new one we've used. It is about the same as the top four U.S. tech companies. So that's Apple, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Microsoft. I also like that Walmart one.
Yeah,
because
there you
that's
go.
The world's largest company, and we're talking about the same value that their total sales are across the world. So that's how we try to get the conversation going.
Sure. Candy Kelly, I'm going to come to you in just a minute, but since we do have a webinar here for reporters, I want to go to our reporter, Anna Gorman, who's covered caregiving for a while. Anna, talk a little bit about some of the changes you've seen in how you've covered it, how the media is covering it. Anna, are you with us? Anna Gorman?
I'm here. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, I'm here.
No problem.
Caregiving on the ground, I cover aging issues as part of my beat in covering health policy, and you're seeing more and more people trying to struggle to do this while they're doing other things. So they're, I'm sure everybody knows, the sandwich generation, they're taking care of kids, they're taking care of their parents, and they're working full time, and it's having an impact. And I know we'll get to this a little bit later, but that's a struggle for people. The other thing that is difficult is that they are being asked to do things that maybe they don't know how to do. If I know I'm an educated person, but if I were to start taking care of an elderly parent or an elderly grandparent, I wouldn't necessarily know what to do, and these people don't either. And while state Medicaid agencies in some states are paying for caregiver families to take care of low-income elderly relatives, a lot of states don't. So people are kind of doing this on their own, and financially, it's a big burden and it's a big hit. So those are just a few of the things that I'm seeing, and I'll jump in on other questions later to add more to the conversation.
Well, great. Next, we're going to go to Kathy Kelly from the Family Caregiver Alliance, and you know our speakers are laying out the largeness of this problem, the importance of it. But what I wanted to ask you was, do you think communities and policymakers are adequately responding to the needs of both the elderly and to their caregivers?
Well, first I want to thank you for the opportunity to present today. I think this is a great panel and a wonderful topic, obviously. Communities and policymakers are responding, and I have to say, as someone who's been in the field for a while, I think in the past 5 years we've really seen sort of like a switch has been flipped, and there's a greater awareness of aging and caregiving. There's lots of new consumer products on the market in the technology field. There's advocacy campaigns that are going on both at the federal and the state and the local levels, which I'll talk about in a minute. And there's new incentives within the ACA. So all of these things have sort of conspired, along with other trends too, but these are the four that I think about to really highlight the issues around family caregiving. So if we can go to federal changes. So we're going to start at the top in terms of federal changes. There's been a number of really positive, developments in Congress. One is a bipartisan caucus, now about 33 members, that truly is bipartisan with Republicans and Democrats, that are coming together to really think about, you know, when legislation comes up or proposed legislation that they may have authored or co-authored across the aisles, that they really give it a shot and to also educate other members of Congress about this issue. The RAISE Family Caregiver Act, the Recognize, Assist, Include, Support, and Engage, which is really a strategy to with specifics to really guide communities and government, employers, providers, and others to get to have some real specific actions that they can take place, just passed in the Senate in the middle of last month. And so you can see there's other things here. I just wanted to highlight those two because they are tending to get the most visibility and the most action at this point. But there's the Care Corps, which is like the America Corps for caregivers, Social Security credit, which I'll talk about a little bit later, and paid family leave. There's also a number of things that are happening sort of, you know, they're not so prominently displayed, which are in rule changes and initiatives that are going out with funding that are asking to include families in the design of programs and new ways of doing business, for example, like in care transitions, you know, at the hospital level. So, and quality metrics. So there's a number of things that are kind of going on in the rule and the administrative, a little bit hidden from what most, you know, Americans would want to, more information they probably want to know about. But they're all positive changes that are moving forward, and it's really, you know, good to at least recognize and highlight those because they're really fundamental changes in the way we're providing incentives and include identification and inclusion and assessment and address the issues of families within larger systems. So that's an emerging trend. And finally, we do have an IOM, an Institute of Medicine report on family caregiving that will be published in 2016. So that will be the benchmark for which other actions will go forward from, and it will be the first report of its type on the national level. So can we switch to the state changes? Excuse me. The states really have had a lot of action, and as you know, it's typical that the states are the laboratories of new programs and initiatives. It's very true of what's happening across the states. The CARE Act, which I know Susan's going to talk about in a minute, is been introduced and passed in a record number of states, and I'll let her address that. But we've also seen states tackle Nurse Practice Act changes in terms of delegated tasks. And you know, a shorthand way of understanding this is that many of the tasks that families do without training, as been mentioned before, paid home care aides are not able to do those tasks. And the Nurse Practice Act really delegates some or all of those tasks to be done under supervision of a nurse. And that enables families, for example, to work uninterrupted instead of having to leave and go home and give a medication to their family member. That's a nurse delegated task. And in many states, a home care aide that you hire is not able to do that. So it's a way in which we're broadening the areas of responsibility, but making it easier for families to maintain their routines, particularly if they're employed. We've seen a lot in caregiver assessment and uniform assessments, and particularly in public programs, which for the first time identify families as part of the care team and assess their needs paid family leave and sick leave has been passed at the state. There's three states that have enacted paid family leave, but sick leave has also been one of the issues at the state level. And then there's sort of these amorphous caregiver planning and advisory boards that are cropping up across the state. So there's a lot of action that's going on at the state level. Next change. The community initiative, we've seen a variety of different projects emerge, but all with some component of caregiver recognition and support. The Villages movement, which is, you know, combining efforts within a certain neighborhood to enable individuals to get types of assistance that they may need. I've seen caregiver issues crop up in county and regional plans. Livable communities typically address caregiving and older adult issues within them. And we've also seen individual tax assessments cropping up in different communities, in counties specifically, or sometimes in cities, to really assess on a special measure to fund services that would specifically support older adults and their caregivers. So we've seen other types of funding strategies emerge as a result. And I also, what's not on the slide, but I also want to make comment that we have seen legislation in various communities that actually address issues such as paid sick time in cities and counties that allow family members to take paid sick time to take their relative to a doctor's appointment or be there at the hospital, those types of functions, and be able to work that into their normal course of caregiving, even though they are employed.
Great, thank you so much. And now we'll go to Susan Reidharn with AARP to talk about the CARE Act.
Yes. So the CARE Act, which stands for Caregiver Advise, Record, and Enable, and that will show up in a later slide here, but this is a direct result of the research that was conducted, that I conducted with my colleague Carol Levine at the United Hospital Fund, and we called it Home Alone. We didn't start with that title, but once we got the findings, we were like, oh my God, how could this be going on like this? So the research showed, which you've already mentioned, that most caregivers now are performing these tasks. I am a nurse, and I often say we are asking family members to do things that would make a nursing student tremble, because I remember giving an injection the first time, and my instructor had calmly put her arm on mine so I would stop shaking. But we just expect family members to just do it. Here's the prescription, go do this, wound care, ventilator care. It's amazing. So that research, our government affairs folks said, well, we got to do something about this. We have to act. And they worked with us to develop this CARE Act. It's very, very simple. The model legislation really just does these three things. The first one is to identify anybody of any age when they are admitted to a hospital, are asked if they have a family member who is helping them, in very broad language. And if it's yes, would you like that person's name in the medical record? That's the first part. And the purpose of that is so you can work with the family. If you're going to have patient and family-centered care, you have to know who you're working with. The second part of that is that they need to be notified before the discharge. They can't get a phone call, pick up mom now, or we put her in a wheelchair and she's at the door, which literally happens. So you have to, ideally 24 hours is in the model legislation. And then finally, if the family caregiver is expected to perform these kinds of tasks, they need to be offered instruction, ideally hands-on instruction with a return demonstration, but videos are coming into play. And I call it anticipatory guidance because many people think they're doing this. Nurses will say, you know, we do this already. And I believe in my heart they think they are, but they answer questions. But the problem is the family caregiver doesn't know what to ask, and they don't even think about it till they get home. So we have to anticipate and teach ahead of time, imagining what they should be asking. So next slide. if you can move to. So this CARE Act is really viewed, I think, as a way to support nurses and other health and social service professionals do what their standards of practice require them to do, and which they really kind of think they're already doing, but make it clear that they do need to do this, and to stimulate new thinking on how to do this. What is the best way to teach? And there's a lot of variation on culture and different family dynamics, so there's a lot to do here, but we do think this is a very important aspect of reducing those hospital readmissions. And many are seeing that, and many states are now saying we've really got to do this for that particular reason. So here's a map right there. So that was just revised on Monday when the governor of New York signed the CARE Act there. And we now have 18 states and Puerto Rico as currently enacted this law. There are, as Kathleen already mentioned, a number of states that are in progress. Pennsylvania just had some action this week. So it is, I like that term, sweeping the nation. Funders are very interested in this, by the way, in evaluating, not so much evaluating, but helping with technical assistance and saying this is kind of the only thing that's going on at the state level. It's very bipartisan. So we're very excited about it, and we're going to keep moving into this next year.
So, again, just to clarify, this is a state initiative,
this is
not a
state
federal
initiative. No, okay. This is a state. Thank you.
Okay.
So let me jump in there, Mary. Let me jump in there. This is Anna. I just want to reiterate for the reporters that this is a really big deal. This is something that could fundamentally change how people will be, how caregivers will be brought into the medical team. And that's kind of something that people are talking about both at the community level, the state level, and the federal level of whether caregivers are kind of outside the circle or inside. And this, the CARE Act, brings them inside. Because as it stands now, oftentimes people are discharged, elderly patients are discharged from the hospital with no instruction to any family member or any paid caregiver or anybody. In fact, a lot of the discharge instructions are given straight to the elderly patient. And the minute they get home, they may have forgotten what it was that they were supposed to do. Or the person picking them up from the hospital may not be the actual caregiver. So there's a big push, I think, both by AARP and the CARE Act and in just communities around the country and in individual hospitals that are trying to prevent readmissions to get caregivers in on the ground floor as they're discharging and as the patient is being cared for in the hospital so that the caregivers know what to do the minute they arrive home so they don't turn around and end up back in the hospital the next day.
That's great. Great to know. And let's go to Edmund Walker on this of HHS about communities and policymakers. Are they adequately responding to the needs of the elderly and the caregivers?
Well, we certainly think that communities and policymakers are responding more than they have in the past. The question that gives me a little pause is the word adequately. I think, you know, many of us would always argue that it's never adequate, but we are so pleased to see that there is a greater acknowledgement and an attempt to address, as you've seen through the map and as we indicated that the states were the initial laboratories for innovation and just really thinking of how to address family caregiving issues. And that's both in the informal, what we used to refer to as informal family caregiver support role, as well as the role of paid direct care workforce. And so we know that from our efforts with the National Family Caregiver Support Program that we see a number of huge challenges that family caregivers face, the first being the issue of stress and not having enough time for themselves, the issue of the financial burden of caregiving. And we also know that through our program, about a third of the family caregivers are spending 40-plus hours a week in terms of providing care, which falls into the category of heavy caregiving. And that has a huge physical toll on the caregiver as well as an emotional toll on the caregiver.
It's almost like another job.
It is more than another job. It reminds me, in fact, of that old book related to caring for a person with Alzheimer's that was called The 36-Hour Day, because caregiving really amounts to something that feels like a 36-hour day every day. We also are seeing that caregiving is varied and it really addresses the complex needs. If you go to, thank you, you have the slide up. In terms of the participants we have, 41% of them indicate that they need information on the condition of their care recipient. 77% indicate that they need, as I mentioned before, legal information. This has changed over time. It's a more complex set of issues and needs of caregivers, and we believe that that will simply continue to increase. We also know that, and this is particularly key for your audience today, in terms of how people learned about our program, certainly you see from the bottom half of the slide that friends and social workers and community-based organizations, as well as state and local offices on aging, contribute a lot to educating individuals about accessing the National Family Caregiver Support Program. But we're so pleased that the media represents 6% of sources of good information. And so we're pleased to provide information to your audience today, and we would encourage your audience to always stick with us in terms of providing additional information to family members, friends, and neighbors who make up more than the bulk of caregiving in this country. It's not through some publicly funded resource that caregiving takes place. It is through family members, friends, and neighbors. And for us, in terms of where people can find help, you see, we operate an elder care locator, which is a service provided by the Administration for Community Living's Administration on Aging, which connects people to local services and information. It's both a web-based service through www.eldercare.gov, as well as a toll-free 1-800 number where individuals, caregivers can call, put in their zip code, indicate what they're looking for, and get resources and assistance in their local community. Also, with regard to respite care, we operate the National Respite Network and Resource Center, and the information is there as well for nationwide respite services.
That's terrifically helpful. We've got a couple questions I'm going to go to in just a minute, but again, I want to remind our audience to please, please send your questions in because this is for you. And also don't forget to tweet with our hashtag, KHN Caregiving. So the first question I want to ask is what will the caregiver ratio number look like in snowbird popular cities like South Florida and Arizona? I want to open that up to the panel. Do you see a change in the ratio number of caregivers in these sort of snowbird states that tend to have a higher elderly population? Susan, I could start with.
Yes, I would. And conversely, you see in states with younger populations that they're doing a little bit better. But it's not hugely different because these are big numbers. But that's why we do have it by state. And, you know, states that are aging faster than other states, you will see differences.
Sure. Would anyone else like to jump in on that? Do you see it sort of a trend, a difference in these snowbird states with the caregiver ratio?
Well, this is Kathy, and I think when you look at the states that have the snowbird ratio, what you're really looking at is the fact that there's not a lot of close family members that live nearby because they've gone, it's retirement states. And that we see a much more likelihood of long-distance caregiving happening. And there's always that judgment call eventually about whether or not, you know, the decision should be made to, you know, put services in place in Florida or Arizona or, you know, those particular types of states, or should they bring that older relative, typically a parent, back to the home community where there's more informal support or more unpaid support that's available to them. And so we do a lot of counseling about those issues on our national calls.
Edwin, are there any federal numbers that indicate anything along these lines about the caregiver ratio number changing in the southern states? I'm not sure if the federal government gathers that kind of data.
No, we don't. The best data we have is through our surveys that we do. And quite honestly, I think that Kathy has indicated exactly what we would think, that many of the older individuals who moved to those snowbird states may need to move back to an area where they have family members to support them and to provide care to them.
Okay. And just a follow-up question, I'm going to send this to you, Susan, about the CARE Act. It's from LaRaza, the publication of LaRaza in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, do caregivers receive any type of financial assistance through the CARE Act?
No. This is very, very simple. It's all about those medical nursing caps.
Okay.
And next, we're going to go to a question. Mandy Woodruff from Yahoo Finance. How do today's caregivers prepare for 2050 when there will be fewer people to care for them? What would they be doing now to prepare? So, again, very interesting question about today's caregivers. They're taking care maybe of an elderly relative. In 2050, they might need somebody to help for them. What should they be doing now to prepare?
Would you like to start?
Susan, start. Start, and then you guys jump in.
At first, I always say have good friends. Don't count on your children.
Oh, great.
You don't really
that
know.
That was my
it
plan.
Might work. It might. But really, I'm serious. I try to avoid social isolation, meet people, help people, build those bonds of reciprocity and all those things. I really mean that. And, of course, take care of yourself. Take care of your health and get your home ready. That's really very important so that you can live as independently as possible for as long as possible.
So you're talking about bars to help you in the shower, this kind
exactly,
of thing.
But also, for example, when I just got a townhouse not too long ago, from a mile from the beach, I'm very excited about it in New Jersey, but I'm really working hard to make sure I could live on the first floor if I had to. So as we redid the kitchen, we opened the door a little wider. So if I was in a wheelchair or my husband was in a wheelchair, you can go through. We're probably going to redo our bathroom. Maybe we can knock out a closet and put a shower in. You know, so this is hopefully years from now that I would ever need this. But think ahead. And it's not just for you, by the way. It's for people who would be visiting you. And people with disabilities, not just older people.
Sure.
So it is a lot of planning. Planning for your financial future, which was a good question about the financial. People underestimate how much money they're going to need to care for themselves in the future. So, but most people don't think about these things.
Okay.
So it's good to have the media prompting it.
How about the rest of the panel? Would you like to chip in?
I would love to echo what Susan just said. I would love to echo what Susan just said. She just identified the indicators of successful aging. It was first identified in a book by Rowan Kahn. And it's all about effectively planning. And here at the Administration for Community Living, Administration on Aging, we focus on getting people to plan ahead. She mentioned housing issues, financial security, remaining socially engaged, and taking care of yourself so that you remain as healthy as possible and don't have to incur deficits with aging health.
This is Kathy, and I agree with Edwin and Susan. I think when we're talking with caregivers and particularly you're alluding to like baby boomer caregivers, which is sort of the largest share at the moment, we're having sort of two conversations. One is about the actual issues that are dealing with their parents, and simultaneously people I think are thinking, well, what about me? And in that way, all the things that were mentioned are really important, but it gets back to having livable communities as well, walkable, accessible public transportation, accessible to healthcare facilities, accessible housing. And a lot of people, just can't give up the dream of living by the lake in an isolated community. But we try to talk, as realistically as possible about those issues and what happens when you do become, you might have some functional disabilities. And it's hard for people to really think about that, but I think, in experiencing caregiving themselves, the issues become a lot more real. And we try to use those issues as a way to educate about their own planning.
From a journalist perspective, that's a good story idea, is just looking at how are people aging in isolated communities or even in rural communities where mm-hmm. they are a little more isolated. They don't necessarily have as many neighbors and friends to check on them on a daily basis. They're not going to the grocery store every day or they're not having visitors. So what does that look like and what are some of the problems that exist now and are going to exist even more in the future?
Mm-hmm. Next, we're going to go to a question from Hallie Stockton from the news website Public Source. This is the question, how do I go about getting state-specific data on the prevalence of caregiving? Is it available on a regional or countywide level, too?
I have it. This is Susan. You can go to our website, AARP, Public Policy Institute, and we have that valuing the invaluable that I mentioned earlier with all of the state-level data. So it will tell you how many caregivers you have in your state, and then it will tell you an estimated dollar value for that number. We do not have it below a state level. It probably could be done. It's not that hard to do, but we don't have that available.
Sure. How about the rest of the panel?
This is Kathy, and actually we have used Susan's data to break that out by counties. It's pretty easy to do. It's just a computational issue. So you can break it out, and we find that really breaking it out by and that level for our state-based, you know, makes a difference for individuals that are looking at programs and initiatives and trying to get that those kinds of estimates in place.
Edwin Walker, is there any sort of federal database on this type of thing?
No, prevalent security. There are the two best sources that exist.
We're having a little bit of a hard time hearing you.
I said, no, you really have just heard from Susan and Kathy about the two best sources of that information.
Okay, that's great to know. We have another question coming in on something that's been in the press lately, maybe a part of the 2016 presidential campaign, from Jason Pendelis. Hillary Clinton, as we know, recently proposed a new tax credit for caregivers that would give families up to $6,000 in caregiving costs for their elderly family members. Here's the question. With the election coming, are there ways that AARP or other groups can help influence, show support for these type of initiatives? I know Susan's not on the lobbying mm-hmm. part of AARP, but Kathy Kelly, I know that you were going to talk about that at some point today. Could you talk a little bit about that Hillary Clinton proposal? What do you think it means for people? Do you think other candidates will follow her? Do you think it will be an issue in the campaigns?
Do you, is it possible to put that particular slide up right now? And
sure, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Well, there are 4 points to her announcement: a 20% tax credit, which is much higher than what we've seen in the past, and probably is more in line with what the expenditures are on an out-of-pocket basis for families on a yearly basis. It also looks at how you improve the direct care worker quality of life. I would surmise there's not a whole lot of details, but this has to do with you know, wage support, maybe benefits, you know, working hours, those all those things that have started to be addressed in other ways from the Department of Labor. Social Security credits for caregivers who have left the workforce. This is a huge financial issue that doesn't get a lot of play, is that Social Security credits are not, you know, obviously accrued for somebody who has dropped out of the workforce, and it means that it, you know, it comes up at a later point. It may be saving money for various systems right now, but down the line, it may mean a less secure retirement for predominantly women who are disproportionately affected by the financial issues. Then funding for respite. There's not specifics on, you know, a lot of specifics on that, but the issue is to recognize that for those who have, you know, dealing with very complex physical and cognitive functions in particular, they're pretty much on duty 24/7, and there is no pathway for significant respite except to bring in, you know, other family members to do that unless they are able to pay privately. So funding for respite, you know, should be that. You know, there are programs that say you have 2 weeks of you know, paid respite available to you, or 4 weeks in some of the VA caregiver support programs. Respite is a really big component. If you are on duty, you know, doing these very complicated tasks, you're pretty worn out and you need a break. So funding for respite is one of those. I might also add that in the election cycle initiatives, there is a family caregiver platform project, which is run out of Alterum under the caregivercorps.org. You can get more information. And that is to get caregiving as a plank in all of the platforms, you know, Republican, Democratic platforms across the states. And that's a very exciting opportunity to do education and to start to address these issues as a as a campaign issue. Hillary's pretty much the first one out the gate, but that doesn't mean that we can't raise these issues when the campaign really gets started. Well, I guess it already has been started, but really in earnest when we have, the Democrats in the primaries and everything else. So we're really looking at that as a way to spread the opportunity to raise the issue.
I wonder if I could ask a follow-up question. Is the Clinton Initiative, is it just for caregiving of seniors only, or does it also apply to other dependent family members?
I can't answer that question. I don't have that much of the specific. I don't know, Susan or Edwin, if you've heard any more on the specifics of that.
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. Well, I can move to Anna for a second. Anna Gorman, could you talk a little bit about, you know, when we talk about the election, we hear mostly about the Affordable Care Act, but with this initiative from Hillary Clinton, do you think other candidates are going to jump in there and do the same thing? Are we going to hear more about these sort of ground-level healthcare policies in the platforms? As, you know, was just described, there's a move to have that happen. How do you see this playing out in the elections in 2016?
Sure. And honestly, Matthew, Mary Agnes Carey, you may know better than I, being there in D.C. I'm out here in California. But I do think that Hillary's proposal got this on the table, right? It wasn't being talked about in the last election cycle, and this is the first time it seems that it's really being brought up. But it's not much money. I mean, what she's proposing is up to about $1,200, offsetting up to about $6,000 in care each year. So it's not a significant amount of money. But she did mention these few different proposals, including the Social Security credits, the respite care, and the tax credit. So whether other people will follow is we're not sure yet. There are some other congressional proposals that we've been talking about a little bit that address caregiving as well. So candidates may jump on those as well. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a politically popular idea, but it is something that is facing both candidates and Congress members because their parents are also aging. So this is an issue that is going to continue to come up in society, and if the candidates are smart, they will respond to it. It's a big population, and the elderly population, a big population of voters. We're all registered voters and likely to get out the vote.
Terrific. Okay. So just for housekeeping purposes, we've got about 12 minutes left. Looking for more questions, of course, from our audience. Also, don't forget about our hashtag, KHN Caregiving. Please get out there on Twitter. And I want to talk a little bit about, we've talked about family caregivers a bit here. Has the job of a family caregiver, has it really increased in its complexity with more families taking on medical tasks? Susan talked about that a little bit a moment ago. I'd like to go back to you, Susan, and have you talk about what sorts of issues does that present for the caregivers and the people that they're caring for when they are asked to do more?
So, you know, we have some data from caregiving in the U.S. that was released this summer. I did this with the National Alliance for Caregiving, Gail Hunt's organization, and AARP Public Policy Institute. And so this is the slide of the average caregiver, which really masks the enormous diversity. But we still are talking about women, although I think Edwin pointed out 40% are men. So men are stepping up to these very complicated tasks. They are just as likely to be giving these medical nursing tasks, that's what we have there, as well as these activities of daily living, that bathing, dressing, all of those kinds of things, and instrumental activities of daily, which also includes financial caregiving, as Edwin also pointed out. So they're doing a lot of different things. And I just wanted to point out the next slide, that we really focused for the first time on these higher hour caregivers. These are people, this is one out of three of caregivers, are doing at least 21 hours of care each week. Now, if you take that one-third, 32% it is, and look at the average within that group, it's 62.2 hours. It's unbelievable. And most of them are working. It's unbelievable how complicated this is going on. They are very often the only caregiver. No one else is helping them. They are more likely to be taking care of a spouse. They have a very high burden of care. They are twice as likely to be in the caregiving role for 10 or more years. 83% of these folks are doing these medical nursing tasks. 42% of those who are doing that said they had no preparation for this work. They are more often to feel stress and physical and financial strain, and they are more likely to be in fair or poor health and to say that caregiving made their health worse, and they often feel they have no choice on taking this. So I just want to point that out, that we are, of course, supportive of all caregivers, but this is a highly vulnerable group of people. And so our entire report in caregiving in the U.S. takes every data piece and divides it between those who are doing less than 21 hours and those who do more, major significant changes across that. And the other one I wanted to point out, which really was quite a surprise to us, we keep talking about boomers, one in four caregivers is a millennial. We had no idea. And by the way, we only started with those 18 plus, and we know they're children who are providing care. So they're 27 years old. They're doing the same thing. Look at this. They're spending 21.2 hours a week. They're still doing these activities of daily, they're doing bathing and dressing, and they're doing instrumental activities of daily living and the medical nursing tasks. And again, they're employed. So I just wanted to point that out. And then one more, caregivers 75 plus older. This is the first time we've looked at this. One in 10 caregivers is over the age of 75. This is a highly, highly vulnerable group of people. They are very involved in communicating with healthcare professionals. 75% of them are doing that. 70% are managing finances. This isn't all on the slide. I'm just telling you more about this. They are more likely to be, again, not have any help from anybody else. So we really need to drill down into these various types of caregivers, I'll say, and see what their specific needs are and how we can target more assistance for millennials, say. Nobody even thinks of them doing this.
Right. That was a surprise when I saw that,
yeah.
For sure.
We have a question from Karen Mitchell, who's a freelancer for NPR. Are there any sorts of stats on the numbers of undocumented folks working as caregivers? There are literally networks of recent mostly female immigrants from various countries who work mostly off the books in this capacity. So the question again is, are there any statistics on the number of undocumented people working as caregivers, with the stress that there are, you know, many female immigrants that may be here working mostly off the books in this capacity? Does anyone have this sort of data? Susan's giving me a note here. How about the panel? I don't know if we have any, if there's any sort of data source on this available.
This is Kathy, and I think, you know, when we're talking about the gray market, the employment of private aides paid privately by family sources, we really don't have our arms around that information at all.
Okay. All right, so now we're going to turn to Anna Gorman, who is a senior correspondent, again, with Kaiser Health News. And since this is a webinar for reporters, Anna's going to wrap things up today to talk about story ideas and resources to help reporters cover family caregiving. So, Anna, you've got the floor.
Great. Can you turn to the resources, a couple further down? There we go. Okay, so we've talked about a few of these. Obviously, our speakers are from Family Caregiver Alliance and the AAR Public Policy Institute. Those are great sites, and we will have these available for you all on the line later, and there's links available as well. The Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute talks more about paid caregiving, but they have great maps and information by state. The White House Conference on Aging, we really didn't get to, but that just happened over the summer, and one of the main policy areas was long-term services and supports. And there was a fact sheet that came out of that with some new policies, so that's worth taking a look at. SCAN Foundation and Hartford Foundation, lower down, both provide grants to different organizations who are doing a lot of work in this area in caregiving. Pew Research Center, the Alzheimer's Association also, of course, have both a lot of research on this area. And then keep your eye out for the IOM study, which came out on family caregiving. I'd be interested to see what that report has and what the ideas it could produce. And then if you could go to the story ideas slides. So I typed up two slide lists of ideas, but then even just in this last 45 minutes heard others. So I want to just mention that this is a topic that some people think, oh, there's already been so much written about caregiving. Oh, we don't really need to write about it. There's been so much written. But it is constantly changing. So I really encourage all of you to jump in on these stories. First of all, on the political issue that we just were talking about with Hillary Clinton's proposal and other proposals, there was a great story in the Washington Post in late October on that. So I encourage you to look at that to just get a good overview of what's happening, and maybe it'll spark some ideas of things to write about in your state. But going through the ones up here, we just talked about this, the elderly caregivers. What does this look like for an over 75-year-old who's taken care of a 95-year-old or an 85-year-old who's taken care of a 100-year-old? What are the issues that come up with that? And on the other side, what does it look like when you're going to college and also taking care of mom? Are you going home and studying while you're, you know, doing wound care? What are some of those issues? We talked about the medical tasks. This also, another story off of that is training. There's a huge controversy nationwide over whether training should be mandated for caregivers, with some family caregivers saying, who are being paid, some family caregivers saying, I don't need to be trained to take care of my daughter or my wife or my aunt who I've been taking care of for all these years, but others saying, look, there's not really requirements to even do basic first aid or to even have basic first aid training. So if the state is going to pay caregivers, well, then maybe they should mandate some training. So that's a possible story as well. I just went to the Gerontological Society on Aging conference last week in Florida, week before last, and there were a whole bunch of panels on different populations, whether it's Latino, Vietnamese, you know, just different ethnic groups, different racial groups, on how caregiving differs by race and ethnicity. Are they more likely to put family members in assisted living or in nursing homes? How do extended families and like a Latino extended family change, or how caregiving is done? How states are addressing family caregiving. Edwin talked about the physical and emotional toll, taking a deeper look at mental health issues, depression among caregivers. Are they getting the help they need? Are there model programs that you could profile where people are getting help for depression and going to support groups as caregivers? And looking at the hospital making caregivers part of the team, I would suggest going into a hospital and seeing somewhere that is either where this is working or where this is not working, and what does it look like? If you could go to the next slide. We didn't really talk too much about this, but technology. There's a lot of new technology to support caregivers, like GPS trackers on Alzheimer's patients or medication reminders, both for caregivers and elderly people in the home on when to take medication. That might be something worth looking at. I'd also be interested in the profile of this caregiver core that one of the panelists mentioned. How are they making this a political issue? Are they creating activists among the elderly population? And then just a couple of those that aren't on here. Looking at model communities, I know there have been some stories about the village programs and the village communities, but are cities starting to make changes? Just like cities started to add bike paths and make cities more walkable, are they also taking into consideration elderly populations as they're doing city planning and as they're building new buildings and new highways and new streets? Is this becoming an issue, especially in areas where there are high numbers of elderly residents? And then the last thing is that legal information. Edwin, I think, mentioned about people needing legal information. So that there's a program called Medical Legal Partnership out of community clinics to help patients. I wonder if there's something similar out there for caregivers and for the people they're taking care of. So as I mentioned, here in just this 5 minutes, there's just endless numbers of stories to write about caregiving and the changing nature, changing demographics of caregiving. So I hope you all will all take a look at some of these and get started on them.
You'll be able to
hand it back over to Mary Agnes.
Thanks, Anna. You'll be able to look at all of Anna's ideas and all the presentations plus supplementary background information that our panelists have provided. We will have that at our site as soon as we can. Again, that's khn.org. Keep this conversation going on Twitter at khncaregiving. And I'd like you to please join me in thanking our panelists Edwin Walker of the Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Community Living, Anna Gorman, my colleague here at Kaiser Health News, Kathy Kelly of the Family Caregiver Alliance, and Susan Reinhardt of AARP's Public Policy Institute. I'd like to thank our audience for participating today, and this concludes the Kaiser Health News webinar on covering caregiving.